says Ted Mosby believed somewhere out there was the one. The one he was meant to be with, the soulmate. And that person, you'd know it when you saw it, and you'd know that's the one I'm supposed to spend the rest of my life with, right? And so he just keeps lurching from relationship to relationship, looking for the perfect experience of love with some person. And that's what motivates the whole sitcom, right? That the universe really wants you to be in love. That is, funny as it is when you say it that way, is a lot closer to how we view love in the modern world than anything else you're likely to get. I'll go a step further. Romanticism is the reason we have the modern LGBTQ movement. Because if the definitive experience for you is the passionate love you have for an individual, I no longer have any guidelines to judge your passionate experience, even if it's for someone with the same sex, you see. And so the motto is, love is love. I'm in love with that person. Who are you to judge me, right? So when you define love in that way, ultimately their argument works, right? In that set of definitions, if the ultimate definition of how you know what love is you feel it, and it's subjective from person to person, then I have no business telling a same-sex couple that their love isn't genuine, if that's what love is. See the problem? So if that's your point of view, you've got no ground to argue that point at all. So guess what? We've got to back up a bit and say, okay, maybe we got off on the wrong foot on what love is. Maybe we're going to have to figure that out because it leads to some funny places if you follow that train of thought very far. Okay, we're in 1 Corinthians 13. What is love? Okay, philosophy aside. Back up a few verses, and somebody read for us verses 4 through 7. So let me give you three categories of human behavior. There's things you do with your mind, things you do with your emotion, and then things that we'll call actions. Okay, so mind, emotion, or action. These words in verses 4 through 7, which category does love fall into? That's a trick question, by the way. Correct answer is yes. It's all those words, if you look at that, it's a large variety of words. Some of them are emotional words. Rejoice, resent, those are emotional words, okay? Believes is an intellectual word. Arrogance is actually an intellectual thing, state of mind, pride. Boasting, being rude, enduring, those are actions, right? So which one is love? Yes, right? It really does touch on every part of what it means to be human. You're not going to be able to pigeonhole it in one category and say, like, maybe the Enlightenment guys went too far and said everything's about rationality and intelligence. Maybe the Romantics went too far and said it's all about emotion. I actually think C.S. Lewis goes too far and says, in his book, he says it's all about behavior. Well, it's a lot about behavior, and it's a lot about emotion, and it's a lot about thinking, right? I mean, it's everything that you are as a human gets wrapped up into love. It really does. It touches every part of you, somewhere. That's the way it's supposed to work. Which is why God can say something like, love God with what? Yeah, heart, mind, soul, strength, or anything. Like every part of you has some component that pertains to love. So I think liking is an emotion, right? Whether I like you or not, that's an emotive term. But love is something a little higher than that. It's more all-encompassing. It's actually, if you read that text, doing what's good for the other person. Love is patient. Is it ever enjoyable to be patient? Is it ever just immediately satisfying to be patient? Yeah, that's a silly question, right? If it's immediately satisfying, you weren't patient. That's not what it always, you're always patient for somebody else's benefit, right? Kind. I mean, I guess it does you some good to be kind, but you're usually being kind to somebody else. If you're being kind to yourself, we don't usually call it kindness. We call it, you know, being selfish usually. But being kind to someone else is being kind. Envy or boast, arrogant or rude, insist on its own way. I mean, these are all of these terms are selfless terms. Things you do for somebody else's benefit. And that's really the root biblical concept of love all the way through. Love is definitely the greatest virtue. Let's do it to 2 Peter. I've already kind of quoted Matthew 22. You remember, what's the first and second great commandment? I won't make you read it. Okay, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Okay, that's the Matthew 22 passage on the screen. We don't have to go read it. But definitely, Jesus puts love at the top of the list. But let's look at 2 Peter 1, 3 through 7. And watch as Peter comes to the same conclusion. 2 Peter 1, somebody wants to read verses 3 through 7. Okay, so the last two, kind of the crown jewels of personal development, are brotherly affection, but even that's not the top. So affection is a good thing. You should develop that. We'll talk about that in another slide here in just a moment. But even above affection is love. Now see, romanticism kind of collapses love down into affection. They're the same thing. If you're affectionate towards somebody, you like somebody, that's love. And Peter says, actually, love is something that's further up the ladder in terms of value that you have to grow into. Affection is not bad. If you get anything out of this lesson, you can put this on the list. Affection is not bad. It's just not best. Right? There's something that's higher up, one step higher on the ladder than even affection and kindness towards other people. And that's love, which is this higher, loftier ideal. Augustine says it like this, which I think is a great quote. For when we ask whether someone is a good man, we're not asking what he believes or what he hopes, but what he loves. If you want to know about somebody, what does he love? What will he act selflessly for? What would he die for? That's usually the thing that he loves. That tells you as much about the person as you're ever going to know. Right? And that's probably fairly true. What about affection? Let's say a few things about that. Having affection for someone does make it easier to love them, right? Can you love people that you don't like? You can. I do believe it's very possible. The fact that I had to stumble over that answer makes my point, though, right? It's not easy. It's not easy at all to be selfless towards somebody that you don't like, who you don't have an affection for. Possible. It's harder. So, Lewis would say, it is our duty to encourage our affections for others. If we want to be loving, we're going to have to do the things that make it easier to love people. Okay? So if love is at the top, you might have to learn some affection before you get there. For most of us. Sir? Yeah. 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 I mean, I don't want to psychoanalyze God, so everyone just, you know, put a big disclaimer asterisk back to what I'm about to say. But when I look at the scene of the death of Jesus, I know that is a perfect expression of love. Did God like us at that precise moment while we're killing Jesus? I don't know if he liked us very much at that moment. I don't think he was pleased with us. Is that fair? The sky turns to darkness, the temple, you know, shakes and the veil tears, and, you know, people are just pretty well terrified for 3 hours. The dead raise and walk around the city. I don't think God's particularly happy with the fact that we've murdered Jesus Christ. I think he loves us. Right? Again, that may be too far. I may have psychoanalyzed God. Maybe I've got no business saying that. But in human terms, that doesn't sound like affection. It does sound like love. Right? He's not giving us a big old hug. But boy, he is dying for us, which is actually greater. Right? So it can exist one without the other. It's usually easier to have affection first for most of us. Yeah. 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 I mean, that's a remarkable statement. Forgive them, they know not what they do. He's hurting. He's in pain. He can't be enjoying himself. And yet, he is demonstrating love towards them, right? And so, yeah, so it's, and even petitioning God on their behalf, which is pretty incredible. Yeah. So I should probably just say it like this. I don't know how he felt towards us at that moment in the human way of speaking. I know that he loved us in that moment. And that's pretty incredible. For us, though, affection helps. Affection reminds you like or you love people even when you're not feeling like it. Folks, there is a reason God made babies cute. Because something has to remind you that you love those little children when they're screaming and pulling your hair and making smelly things and all the things that babies do and keeping you up all night. Okay, I like you. You know. You need a little reminder, a little encouragement in love at those moments. Okay, even as lofty as love is. Can affection ever hinder love? Can affection ever get in the way of love? That's a tough question, but that does help you to see how they're different. I would say yes, it can. I don't want anyone I like to ever hurt or feel pain. Are there some things that are in people's best interest that are not pleasant, though? Okay. Mamas and daddies, did you take your kids to get, I don't know, shots or go to the dentist? I got a dentist on the next screen. Dentist. Okay. And this is Lewis's favorite example. He says, have you ever been to the dentist? His favorite example. And remember, this is in the age before good anesthesia for dentists, okay? Have you been to the dentist? He said, is it a pleasant experience? No. Is it good for you? Yes. Okay. Parents, would you take your kids to the dentist? If you love them, you say, that's probably something I'm supposed to do. That would be a loving thing to do. Oh, I just can't stand to see him hurt, though. That's no fun. And they say they don't want to go. See the difference? Like, if I am only going to act as a friend to them, as a person who's affectionate to them, I might say, well, I don't want to do anything they don't like. I don't want them to suffer any kind of hardship or suffering or pain or even inconvenience. That's affection. But love actually even goes a step further and says, well, in this particular case, something that hurts is actually the only loving response, right? And so that might be an instance. We have to be careful not to confuse affection with love, even though they're closely related, or subordinate love to affection. Love is the better one. Affection is secondary. And Sometimes that's uncomfortable. Yes, ma'am? My favorite passage in the Bible about parenting, I'll just read it to you, but if you want to jot it down somewhere, this is 1 Kings chapter 1 and verse 6. David, at this point, was a very old man, and he's got just a few sons left. Most of his sons have killed themselves off through, you know, chaos and bloodshed. He's got Solomon and Adonijah. Adonijah would like to be king. This is what the Bible says, beginning in verse 5, 1 Kings 1, 5. Now Adonijah the son of Haggith exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. This is verse 6. His father had never at any time displeased him by asking, why have you done thus and so? He was a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom. Fair-haired boy. And the Bible said David never displeased him. Anyone want to know what happens to Adonijah? He's dead at the end of the next chapter. Okay, he tries to usurp Solomon's place. It ends poorly. He had a sense of entitlement. He says, I will be king, and those are my chariots. And David had never said no to him. I don't know if it was because, again, maybe David's late in life, or this was a son from another. Haggith, I don't know who Haggith even is. Solomon's son of Bathsheba, is that right? Yeah. So I'm not sure who Haggith is. But raised by somebody else. But whatever it is, he hadn't been a good father to Adonijah. And the way the Bible expresses that, this beautiful little phrase, he never displeased him. If you've never done anything your kids didn't like, you did a bad job. I know the New Testament says don't provoke them to wrath. You're not supposed to torment them. You're not supposed to be a tyrant. But if you never in your life do anything your kids don't like, you've done a bad job. And that's the meaning of it. He never displeased him at any time. Yeah. Jim, were you going to add something to that? You had your hand up. Yeah.
And it's for their own protection. And, well, do we just let them stay where they are and not take the man's way they're supposed to take them? And
yeah.
Possibly still want to drive an automobile and their ability to repair. So there are certain times that you simply have to take the control of their horns and say, well, this is what has to be done for their own protection. And the child loves them to do that. And
yeah.
They don't see that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, for the last 2 years, I've been kind of on the bat phone, the background communication for the Hamrick kids and Bill and Lenora, as they reached a point, especially Bill in health, and David would call or message, how is he actually doing? And that conversation, I tried to mostly stay out of it and let the kids and parents talk. But from time to time, Bill and Lenora would tell me about the kids are saying this, and the kids would say, well, Bill and Lenora aren't doing. And nobody, you know, enjoys that. But at the end of the day, the loving thing to do was to take care of your parents. And that didn't mean them being up here. It meant them being down in Texas. And Bill and Lenora came to grips with that because they're wise people. Took them a while. As David will tell you, but Lenora gets to take all time she wants, is the way I see it. So anyway, but yeah, it was ultimately a loving action. Yeah, actual love wouldn't do something harmful to another person, even though we both enjoy it. And there are some behaviors, sexually and romantically, that are harmful to both of us. And that's just not part of the conversation today. But you're right. Real love would say, we both like this, but it's hurting both of us. It's not good morally or physically or spiritually for either one of us. That's real love would say that. Yep. Yeah. An affair isn't love because it's unseemly, right? Love doesn't have to be hidden. Love doesn't say, let's break the rules so we can be together. Love says, let's be honorable. So I had to do a little project once upon a time. I had to find pop culture descriptions of the David and Bathsheba story. And it was for an Old Testament class, and we had to say, you know, how is this perceived in culture? And I went back, and I found this movie from the 60s, maybe further back. It was it was color, but it was an older movie, a Hollywood rendition of David and Bathsheba, and I played the trailer for the class, and it portrays the David and Bathsheba story as this passionate love affair, people whose love caused them to defy the law of God, you know, and that's how they sold it. It was a romance movie, right? Well, that's a much sexier take on that story than the actual story. The story just says he saw her and he slept with her and that was that, right? But we would see it that way, right? That we want it to be that. When in reality, that's unseemly. That's not love. That, in reality, what David did was a lot closer to rape than what it was an actual meaningful relationship. It was unseemly. It was awful. He killed a man, right? Love doesn't kill off somebody's husband. It's unseemly. Yeah, it's a good example. When you're trying to figure out how and or whether you love someone, I think there's a typo up there, whether you love your brother, Lewis says there's a good idea. Just act like you do, and the feelings will come around eventually. What's funny is this is actually completely unrelated to C.S. Lewis, was what I was taught in counseling classes. They give you what's called the cognitive triangle, that there's three parts of human behavior, like I said a minute ago. There's thoughts and feelings and actions. And if you want to change one of them, you work on the other two, or the triangle, okay? So if somebody comes and they want counseling and they say, Ben, I'm having trouble with the way I feel about this person. We don't talk about their feelings. We talk about their behavior and their thoughts. And then eventually the other one kind of pops out. And goes, oh, okay, we fixed it. And if they're having problems with their behavior, we talk about how they think and how they feel. And we keep talking about thinking and feeling and thinking and feeling. And eventually your behavior is going to get on board with thinking and feeling if they're in the right place. See the point? So when it comes to love, that cognitive triangle really does work. That if you're worried, I don't know if I feel loving. Well, how do you think about them? I know I'm supposed to love them. Okay, that's a start. Do you act lovingly towards them? Yeah. Okay, if you'll fake it for a little while, and if you, intellectually you know you're supposed to love them, you might be surprised. If you just keep working on those two, the affection just kind of falls out of it. Same way, I don't know if I'm treating that person lovingly or not. Well, if you think you love them, and you feel like you love them, and you keep working on those two, eventually you're probably going to act like it, right? So the point is, if you can get two of those points of the triangle on board with love, you can usually kind of shoehorn the other one into agreement. And so Lewis's point is, fake it. You know, if you're not sure, act like it. Well, isn't that disingenuous and hypocritical? No. I'd rather you be polite by faking it than be mean, honestly, to be honest with you, right? I mean, it doesn't do you any good. I'm going to be really honest and I don't like you, right? That doesn't help anything. Treat them politely. Treat them kindly. Be selfless towards them. Before long, might decide you really love them. Yeah. Yeah, at that moment, I don't know how God felt towards us, but I'm suspicious, you know. But what does he do? He is committed to loving us, and he acts out that love to an extreme that we've never seen before. I don't question God's love one little bit, do you? I mean, he's... If there was any question on the feeling... Again, I don't know how God feels. I'm not sure how that works. But if there was any question there, you're absolutely right. I mean, the rest of that makes the decision for us. And that can work in a church setting too. Because at least two of those ought to be easy in a church setting. Okay? If you've even opened up a Bible, the thought part, you know you'd better be loving people, right? So there's the thought part. And in a church building, if there's any place you can act like you'll love people, I would hope it would be here, right? Maybe we don't. But boy, I would like to think this would be, if it's going to be easy anywhere, it ought to be here. So you get those two going. You think you love people, and you act like you love people, day after day after day after day after day, you might turn out to actually be affectionate towards them. You know, the other one might just hop on board. This is kind of a gymnasium for love. It's a training ground, right? We're practicing. And eventually we get it sorted out. Now that says, Lewis gives us a warning, that law works in reverse too. Good and evil both increase in proportion to their practice. Love and hate grow like snowballs. What if instead of nurturing those aspects of love, you harbor resentment and feed that? Eventually it can win too. And you stop even thinking you love people. You certainly stop acting like you love people. See? So both of them can be a snowball. That's why all of our actions, even small ones, are so important. Because they're making us into one thing or another. They're adding up to something. I don't mean to terrify you, but when Jesus says every idle word we brought into judgment, I don't think he means on the day of judgment, he's literally got a book, and he says, Denny, May 30th, 1997, you said, and that's everything else was good, but that one, you're a goner, right? I don't think that's what he meant, but what I do think he means is, there are no actions, even if you think it was idle, that doesn't have consequences. We call them idle words. He says they're judgment, right? That everything you do or say adds up. And it makes you into a person who's either more loving or less loving, more sinful or less sinful. It all adds up. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
But each person is tempted when he was lured and enticed by his own desire. His desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death.
Yeah.
That circle of it starts here, it ends here, and then you have.
Yeah, yeah. It started with I'd kind of like that, and ended up dead. Well, that escalated quickly, but that's exactly how it develops. So you have to be aware of feelings and thoughts and actions. And make sure we're cultivating love as much as possible in those areas. Any more thoughts on that? That's pretty important stuff, actually. Okay. What about God's love and loving God? Loving God involves answering the question, if I loved God, what would I do? And then doing it. It's pretty self-explanatory, Lewis being kind of snarky there, I think. Loving God is deciding, what would it be if I loved God? Okay, I'll do that, right? And what he means by that is, you may not even feel yet that you love God. But can you decide to love God and act lovingly towards God before you even feel lovingly towards God? He says the same thing as for other people. Are there days in your life when you're a little cranky with God? Disease strikes a family member, and you prayed and prayed and prayed, and they didn't get better. How did Job feel about God? Not great, I'm thinking. I suspect he was frustrated at the least. And so what does he lean on? How do I think and how do I act? You know, and that's the rest of the book of the Job, right? I kind of feel like I'm supposed to love God. I think I'm supposed to love God. I think God's taking care of me. Doesn't seem like it today. I'm not very happy about it. But he's still thinking and arguing about it, right? And so sometimes loving God works that way. We know God's word, or God's love for us, means he always seeks and provides for our good. He's always acting towards us with love, even especially when we're unlovable, right? That's the whole Bible story in a nutshell. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly, right? He didn't love us because of how cute and adorable we were. He loved us while we are at our ugliest. Love apparently means more than just finding something attractive. Okay. So Lewis, in his comforting way, says, "But the great thing to remember is that though our feelings come and go, his love for us does not. It is not wearied by our sins or our indifference. And therefore, it is quite relentless in its determination that we shall be cured of those sins at whatever cost to us, at whatever cost to him." The relentless love of God, that'd be a good sermon, right? Just relentless. At whatever cost to us, will God take us to the dentist? Yes, he will. Will God allow us sometimes to suffer in order to develop and to grow? Apparently so. I don't like it. Whatever cost to us, at whatever cost to him. And of course, that's the story of Jesus. Okay. I wanted to throw this in just from Augustine because I think it's fun. Augustine said, "Love is so important, everything else good about you comes out of getting love right. You get love right, everything else works." Okay. He says, "I hold that virtue is nothing other than perfect love of God. We may therefore define these virtues as follows. Temperance is love preserving itself entire and incorrupt for God. Courage is love readily bearing all things for the sake of God. Justice is love serving only God and therefore ruling well everything else that is subject to the human person. Prudence is love discerning well between what helps it toward God and what hinders it." Everything is about love. He also said, "All sin is getting love wrong." The way he said it was, all sin is disordered love. When love isn't what it's supposed to be, that's when sin develops. Let me, for sake of time, that's my next slide. Augustine claimed that all sin is disordered love, but living a just and holy life requires one to love things, that is to say, in the right order. How do you do that? He says, well, don't do the following. Do not love what is not to be loved. Are there some things you shouldn't love? Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. For all that is in the world, lust of the eye, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but of the world. Love the world, enmity with God. 1 John, paraphrase, 1 John 2, 15 through 17. Didn't quote that just right. Yeah, if you love the wrong things, in fact, if you love things, how about that? We get it backwards. You're supposed to use things and love people. We love things and use people. That's backwards. Okay. So some things are simply not to be loved. Do not fail to love what is to be loved. There are some things you're supposed to love. 1 John again, 4, 7, and 8 says, how can you love your brother that you do see, or love your God that you don't see, and fail to love your brother that you do see? How's that possible? Right. There are some things you're supposed to love. And if you don't love those things, you're not getting love right. Do not have a greater love for what should be loved less. Jesus says that in a really weird way in Luke 14, 16. If you don't hate father and mother and come after me, hate in the New Testament seems to mean something like love second. Right? If you love one of your kids more than your second kid, the second kid says, "Why do you hate me?" I love you. Yeah, you love me second. Right? When it comes down to it, you love that one first. when they ask questions like that. That's why. Yeah. So hate in the New Testament is like second love. So, yeah, I love my mom and dad. Second to God is the way Jesus is spelling it out. And we can get those backwards. Romanticism does. Romanticism tells your spouse, I love you even above my God. Backwards. It's disordered. You love your spouse better when you love your God first. There's a right way to do that. So some things are to be loved less than others. Do not have an equal love for things that should be loved less or more. Right? Dad would, you know, oh, what's the old country song about, I love little baby ducks and pickup trucks and whatnot, and I love you. Dad would never sing it that way. Now, Dad can't carry a tune in the bucket, but he would sing that song and replace the word love with like. I like little baby ducks, but I love you. And that was his way of making a distinction that what I have for you isn't what I have for little baby ducks. Swell as they are, it's not the same. Huh? Tom T. Hall, thank you, sir. So not all things are to be loved the same. Do not allow a lesser or greater love for things that should be loved equally. Back to our kids. If you love one more than the other and you weren't supposed to, that's a dangerous love. Pretty much every bad story in the book of the Genesis or the Old Testament starts with somebody loving people unequally. Loving one son more than another, or in an age when they had multiple wives, loving one wife more than another, that always ends well, right? A love that is differentiated like that always ends badly. Christian love, instead, is from God, not merely a natural affection, though it can be supported by natural affection. It is driven by God's love rather than the attractiveness of the object. Christian love is sacrificial and selfless, rather than self-serving. Any questions on love? Everyone understands love perfectly. Well, then I've done my job. Thank you.